30 kilos up and birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents. A zoo in central France is welcoming the birth of a male giraffe after 15 months of waiting. The calf is named after Melman, the giraffe character in the Madagascar movie franchise. He was born on Sunday in a Beauval Zoo park. He is 170 centimeters tall and weighs 55 kilograms. Zookeepers say Melman is a special baby.
A giraffe birth here. It's our second birth since we've had the group of females established for a few years. So for us, it's still quite an important and exceptional event because it's not every day that we have a giraffe birth.
The giraffe keepers say Melman stood on his feet for the first time 45 minutes after being born. Since zoos have opened in France, visitors can enjoy seeing little Melman playing around with his mother. The birth of the baby giraffe is good news for wildlife preservation, as according to estimates, the number of the animal in the wild has dropped by about 30% since the 1980s.
The issue of marine trash has long worried scientists and environmentalists. Now a French engineer has invented a robot to help clean ocean waste. The Jellyfish Bot is a remote-controlled, electric-powered boat that helps clean rubbish from the surface of the water. It's 70 centimeters long and 70 wide, almost the size of a suitcase. The robot can collect everything from plastic bottles to masks and even oil and petrol. Despite its wide-ranging utility, Jellyfish Bot has a rather simple mechanism.
To collect trash, you have to do something as simple as possible, because otherwise, if we put too complicated mechanisms, it can get blocked and things can get stuck in the system. We designed the robot with a slide mechanism that goes towards a net, so we fill up the net, we take back the net, and that's the end of it.
The trash-collecting robot is being used at around 15 ports in France, lightening the workload of local cleaners. It has also been exported to countries including Japan, Norway, and Singapore. The makers have also developed an autonomous version of the boat.
Malaysians at a vaccination center in the city of Kuching have witnessed a surprising scene. A T-Rex turned up to get his COVID-19 jab. Fitness instructor Kenny Sia dressed up in a dinosaur costume to amuse people, doesn't he look fabulous, and protect himself. Sia said he made the decision to lift up the spirits of frontline health workers is exhausted by vaccinating over 5,000 people a day. People rushed to take pictures with him, hailing his appearance and historic and funny. A giant 3D cat has risen to fame in the Japanese capital, Tokyo, bringing joy to citizens amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A massive billboard featuring the cat has been installed in one of Tokyo's busiest districts. The realistic-looking cat on a 4K resolution screen appears every few minutes between advertisements. Depending on the time of day, the cat appears differently and sometimes meowing at people walking by. The companies that set up the billboard hope that they can cheer people up during the dark era of the coronavirus pandemic. The display has already caused a frenzy in the city and among the social platforms, with many expressing joy and amazement at the technology.
Peru is full of natural wonders worthy of appreciation in each of its regions. A zoo in the capital, Lima, has now unveiled an incredibly cute and adorable Andean alpaca calf to attract visitors amid dwindling zoo-goers due to the coronavirus pandemic. This furry baby alpaca named Paquita is just 1 month old and was introduced to the public on the eve of the 200th anniversary of Peru's independence from Spain. The zoo has also displayed its families of llamas, alpaca, and vicuña. The three are members of South American camelids biological family and are traditionally valued for their soft and warm wool. They live in the Andes Mountains, which lay thousands of meters above sea level. Peruvians are proud of the history of wools associated with these species, which have common ancestors with camels.
Four German tightrope walkers have set a new world highlining distance record by crossing an Arctic valley in Sweden. The group tiptoed a distance of more than 2 kilometers between two mountain peaks in Lapland barefoot. The line they walked on was set at a height of 600 meters. The four members of the team walked the line one after another successfully, despite challenges including the wind and long distance. It took 2 days for the team to rig the line between the two peaks.
A herd of elephants migrating in China have been making headlines for months. Now they have once again attracted attention. Experts monitoring the animals this week noticed two females engaged in a dramatic fight over the herd's leadership, where they kicked and bit each other. The tussle soon ended after a male elephant succeeded in calming the belligerent giants. The fight happened in China's southwestern province of Yunnan. The herd embarked on a lengthy journey last year after escaping a nature reserve and has since trekked hundreds of miles. The elephant's migration is the longest one in China's history.
Eid al-Adha, or Feast of the Sacrifice, is a major Islamic holiday celebrating the willingness of Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. Eid Mubarak.
In the limelight.
Vivek Murthy, the U.S. Surgeon General, who has accused companies, including Facebook, of poisoning information about coronavirus vaccines, said they were not doing enough to check the online proliferation of false claims. We're prepared for you an article written by Richard Luscombe. Richard Luscombe was a journalist working for the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, U.S. Surgeon General Says COVID Misinformation Spreading Like Wildfire on Social Media. President Joe Biden's administration renewed its assault on social media companies spreading COVID-19 misinformation recently, as new infections continue to surge across the United States. Vivek Murthy, the U.S. Surgeon General, who has accused companies, including Facebook, of poisoning information about coronavirus vaccines, said they were not doing enough to check the online proliferation of false claims. Murthy said on Fox News recently, "The reality is that misinformation is still spreading like wildfire in our country, aided and abetted by technology platforms." He added, "I'm worried about what is to come because we're seeing increasing cases among the unvaccinated in particular. It's so important people have the information they need about the vaccine. It is our fastest, most effective way out of this pandemic." The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, reported on Friday, 16th of July, that new cases of COVID-19 in the United States, fueled by the highly transmissible Delta variant of the virus, have surged by 70% in a week to more than 26,300 a day. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said cases were rising in 48 states and stagnant in other two states. Four states, California, Florida, Missouri, and Texas, were responsible for 46% of the new cases, with one in five coming in Florida. The CDC's director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, said on Friday, 16th of July, "This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated," noting that only 48.5% of U.S. adults were fully vaccinated and that 99.5% of new hospitalizations from COVID-19 were people who had not received a vaccine shot. The U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy's recent comments came after a spat between the federal government and Facebook, sparked by President Joe Biden's statement recently that the company was killing people by failing to curb the spread of misinformation over vaccines. Meanwhile, prominent Republican politicians and right-wing television personalities have been publicly skeptical about vaccinations, leading to a reluctance among their supporters to receive them. Facebook hit back on Saturday with a blog post highlighting the steps it has taken, including the removal of more than 18 million pieces of misinformation. In interviews, company officials have accused the Biden administration of seeking scapegoats for its own failure to reach Biden's target of having 70% of U.S. adults at least partially vaccinated by 4th of July holiday, and claimed that, privately at least, Vivek Murthy had praised the company's efforts. However, on Sunday, 18th of July, the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said his view of social media companies was unchanged. He told CNN's State of the Union program, "Some have worked to try to up-promote accurate sources, like the CDC and other medical sources. Others have tried to reduce the prevalence of false sources in search results. But what I have also said to them, publicly and privately, is that it's not enough, and we're still seeing a proliferation of misinformation online." Vivek Murthy added, "And we know that health misinformation harms people's health. It costs them their lives. Health misinformation takes away our freedom and our power to make decisions for us and for our families. The platforms have to recognize they have played a major role in the increase in speed and scale with which misinformation is spreading." Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democratic senator from Minnesota, said on Sunday, 18th of July, that she believed Facebook should face consequences and referred to a so-called Dirty Dozen online personalities that a study said was responsible for 65% of COVID-19 misinformation generally and 73% on Facebook. She told CNN, "Look at the numbers from the Kaiser Foundation. Two-thirds of people who have not got vaccinated say it's because they have got something off of social media." She added, "For months I've been taking on the Dirty Dozen. Some have been taken off of their accounts. But there's more to do. We also should look at changing the liability standard when it comes to vaccine misinformation. There's absolutely no reason they shouldn't be able to monitor this better and take this off of their platforms." A CBS News poll published recently showed growing hesitancy to receive a vaccine. 53% of respondents in the new poll said they worried about side effects, up from 43% in June, and 45% said they don't trust the science behind the vaccines, a rise of 12% from the previous month. In Missouri, one of the states with the lowest vaccination rates in the United States, a spike in cases has led to hospital officials taking to Twitter to urge residents to get a vaccine shot. Ken McClure, the mayor of Springfield, Missouri, said circulating misinformation was at least partly responsible for the rise. He told CBS's Face the Nation, "People are talking about health-related fears, what it might do to them later on in their lives, what might be contained in the vaccinations." Ken McClure added, "That information is just incorrect, and I think we as a society and certainly in our community are being hurt by it. The surge is coming. The Delta variant of the virus will be there. It's going to spread. It's already spreading throughout Missouri. Hopefully people can learn what we've been experiencing here in Springfield."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grumman-Prez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
Heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
It destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell by that. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby the BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, one biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroys the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic because it is a lot to digest.
Mm. And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited, and it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today, without watching this film, it's like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this film...
Of course, that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well, because ultimately... For any cinematic experience, I'd walk away with what was the impact. The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching... And why was that? Yeah.
Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high-profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come into the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
Mm. I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Mm. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. Mm. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multimillion dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
Mm. So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary. But we'll just have to move swiftly on just for now.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned a study
by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this million-dollar contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
Really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Maria, what was your reaction to the connections being made between the U.S. military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world, as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity, and it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer that lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. Mm-hmm. It's disgusting. It's appalling, and you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life, though.
Yeah, maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy because he does everything via Twitter, and we have the biggest arms deal. I'm putting that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not, because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
Mm. And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrogant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history, and I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached, at the start of the transatlantic slave trade, because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization, but this was the first time it was actually industrialized. Mm-hmm. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a fascinating point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move swiftly on, and we'll pick up your next point in the next part of the discussion.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, spent 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, dozens of other places I've been and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark schmaltzy, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously, is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, smacked down. And they try to gag them. Mm. And that's appalling. And it shouldn't happen, but it does. And it's still happening today. Mm.
And it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep this sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that,
Tessa? A marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression they actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything, they're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? Mm. I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... the African National Congress. Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in new Labour and was, the spiritual light here, who's going to bring all this hope, and yet, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you have Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the Sirius Fraud
Office, I believe,
having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him. And he said, no, you need to stop this, otherwise we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round, and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less. That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it. But then he was, Teflon Tony, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
Their documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. But the thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Well, this takes us to a really good, great point. We're just going to move on again.
Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify all these tanks, all these planes, all this bullshit?
What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew he could get away with it. And he has, And that poor woman was the one that was then ostracized and found it very difficult later on in her career. Mm-hmm. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? Mm-hmm. What can we do?
Mm-hmm. And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of... How Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behaved literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So... And it's the confidence of knowing that he could pull her leash in at any time he wanted. And sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult. But I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he is associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new. But
It's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white, or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen, because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
so, just your final thoughts on the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, that people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Very powerful note to end it on. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In delivering vaccines, pharmaceutical companies aided by monumental government investments have given humanity a miraculous shot at liberation from the worst pandemic in a century. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Peter Goodman, Apurva Mandavili, Rebecca Robbins, and Martina Stevis-Gridneff. The piece is titled, What Would It Take to Vaccinate the World Against COVID? Stay with us for more. Delivering vaccines, pharmaceutical companies aided by monumental government investments have given humanity a miraculous shot at liberation from the worst pandemic in a century. but wealthy countries have captured an overwhelming share of the benefit. Only 0.3% of the vaccine doses administered globally have been given in the 29 poorest countries, home to about 9% of the world's population. Vaccine manufacturers assert that a fix is already at hand, as they aggressively expand production lines and contract with counterparts around the world to yield billions of additional doses of vaccines. Each month, 400 million to 500 million doses of the vaccines from Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson are now being produced, according to an American official with knowledge of global supply. But the world is nowhere close to having enough. About 11 billion shots of the vaccine are needed to vaccinate 70% of the world's population, the rough threshold needed for herd immunity, researchers at Duke University estimate. Yet so far, only a small fraction of that has been produced. While global production is difficult to measure, the analytics firm Airfinity estimates the total so far at 1.7 billion doses. The problem is that many raw materials and key equipment remain in short supply, and the global need for vaccines might prove far greater than the current estimated, given that the coronavirus presents a moving target. If dangerous new variants emerge, requiring booster shots and reformulated vaccines, demand could dramatically increase, intensifying the imperative for every country to lock up supply for its own people. The only way around this zero-sum competition for doses is to greatly expand the global supply of vaccines. On that point, nearly everyone agrees. But what is the fastest way to make that happen? On that question, divisions remain stark, undermining collective efforts to end the pandemic. Some health experts argue that the only way to avert catastrophe is to force drug companies to relax their grip on their secrets and enlist many more manufacturers in making vaccines. In place of the existing arrangement, in which drug companies set up partnerships on their terms while setting the prices of their vaccines, world leaders could compel or persuade the industry to cooperate with more companies to yield additional doses at rates affordable to poor countries. Those advocating such intervention have focused on two primary approaches: waiving patents to allow many more manufacturers to copy existing vaccines, and requiring the pharmaceutical company to transfer their technology, that is, help other manufacturers learn to replicate their products. The World Trade Organization, WTO, the de facto referee in international trade disputes, is the venue for negotiations on how to proceed. But the institution operates by consensus, and so far, there is none. The Biden administration recently joined more than 100 countries in asking the World Trade Organization to partially set aside vaccine patents. But the European Union has signaled its intent to oppose patent waivers and support only voluntary tech transfers, essentially taking the same position as the pharmaceutical industry, whose aggressive lobbying has heavily shaped the rules in its favor. Some experts warn that revoking intellectual property rules could disrupt the industry, slowing its efforts to deliver vaccines, like reorganizing the fire department amid an inferno. "We need them to scale up and deliver," said Simon Evernett, an expert on trade and economic development at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland. "We have this huge production ramp up. Nothing should get in the way to threaten it." Others counter that trusting the pharmaceutical industry to provide the world with vaccines helped create the current chasm between vaccine haves and vaccine have-nots. The world should not put poorer countries in this position of essentially having to go begging or waiting for donations of small amounts of vaccine, said Dr. Chris Behrer, senior scientific liaison to the COVID-19 Prevention Network. Dr. Chris Behrer added, "The model of charity, I think, is an unacceptable model. In this fractious atmosphere, the World Trade Organization's leaders are crafting their proceedings less as a push to formally change the rules than as a negotiation that will persuade national governments and the global pharmaceutical industry to agree on a unified plan. Ideally, in the next few months." The Europeans are banking on the notion that the vaccine makers, fearing patent waivers, will eventually agree to the transfer of technology, especially if the world's richest countries throw money their way to make sharing know-how more palatable. Many public health experts say the patent waivers will have no meaningful effect unless vaccine makers also share their manufacturing methods. Waivers are akin to publishing a complex recipe. Technology transfer is like sending a master chef to someone's kitchen to teach them how to cook the dish. If you're to manufacture vaccines, you need several things to work at the same time. The World Trade Organization's Director General, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, told journalists recently, "If there is no transfer of technology, it won't work." Even with patent waivers, technology transfers, and expanded access to raw materials, experts say it would take about 6 months for more drug makers to start churning out vaccines. The only short-term fix, they and European leaders say, is for wealthy countries, especially the United States, to donate and export more of their stock to the rest of the world. The European Union allowed the export of hundreds of millions of doses, as many as it kept at home, while the United States held fast to its supply. But boosting donations and exports entails risk. India shipped out more than 60 million doses of the vaccine this year, including donations, before halting vaccine exports a month ago. Now, as a wave of death ravages the largely unvaccinated Indian population, the government is drawing fire at home for having let go of doses. The details of any plan to boost vaccinations worldwide may matter less than revamping the incentives that have produced the status quo. Wealthy countries, especially in the West, have monopolized most of the supply of vaccines, not through happenstance, but as a result of economic and political realities. Companies like Pfizer and Moderna have logged billions of dollars in revenue by selling most of their doses to deep-pocketed governments in North America and Europe. The deals left too few doses available for COVAX, a multilateral partnership created to funnel vaccines to low- and middle-income countries at relatively low prices. While the partnership has been hampered by multiple problems, most recently India's blocking exports amid its own crisis, the snapping up of doses by rich countries was a crucial blow. "We as high-income countries made sure the market was lopsided," said Mark Eccleston-Turner, an expert on international law and infectious diseases at Keele University in England. "The fundamental problem is that the system is broken, but it's broken in our favor. Changing the calculus may depend on persuading wealthy countries that allowing the pandemic to rage on in much of the world poses universal risk by allowing variants of the virus to take hold, forcing the world into an endless cycle of pharmaceutical catch-up. It needs to be global leaders functioning as a unit to say that vaccine is a form of global security," said Dr. Rebecca Weintraub, a global health expert at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Weintraub suggested that the G7, the group of leading economies, could lead such a campaign and finance it when the members convene in England next month. The argument over COVID vaccines harkens back to the debate over access to antiretroviral drugs for HIV in the late 1990s. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved the first powerful HIV drug therapy in 1995, resulting in a plunge in deaths in the United States and Europe, where people could afford the therapy. But deaths in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia continued to climb. In 2001, the WTO ruled that countries could allow local companies to break patents for domestic use, given an urgent need. The ruling is still in place, but without technology transfers, few local pharmaceutical companies would be able to quickly replicate vaccines. In 2003, the World Trade Organization, WTO, took a crucial further step for HIV drugs, waiving patents and allowing low-income countries to import generic versions manufactured in Thailand, South Africa, and India, helping to contain the epidemic. With COVID, the request for a patent waiver has come from the South African and Indian governments, which are seeking to engineer a repeat of that history. In opposing the initiative, the pharmaceutical industry has reprised the argument it made decades ago. Any weakening of intellectual property rights or IP protection discourages the investment that yields life-saving innovation.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
But these have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quilts, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing. And no one had searched for them.
a former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School, has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.